today on Against the Grain. When the system is stacked against you, when mainstream society sidelines you, or worse, what do you look for in liberatory possibilities? I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with Eve Dunbar about her book, Monstrous Work and Radical Satisfaction, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Let's say that finding work in the formal economy means being exploited. That failing to measure up to mainstream conceptions of beauty means feeling debased. That being black in a racist society means being treated like dirt, or worse. In such cases, what does one do? Is satisfaction of a meaningful kind possible? How does one find a measure of autonomy, a sense of freedom and possibility? In her new book, Eve Dunbar considers how four mid-20th century black women writers insisted on satisfaction and not merely survival. As Dunbar writes, the literary works of Anne Petrie, Gwendolyn Brooks, Dorothy West, and Alice Childress establish the fullness of experience, the joy of self-sufficiency, and a refusal to measure life by standards meant to exclude black womanhood. Eve Dunbar is the Jean Webster Professor of English at Vassar College. Her new book is Monstrous Work and Radical Satisfaction, Black Women Writing Under Segregation. When Eve and I connected recently, I pointed to the phrase monstrous work in her book's title and asked what she meant by monstrous.
I think that there's a little bit of reclamation or language reclamation there. So part of what I mean by monstrous is the ways in which Black people in general, when they are not working toward what we might call normative inclusion or normativity, they are seen often, at least in the works that I'm reading, as working against the state. And that work against the state has severe repercussions often, from, let's say, death in some cases to social political exclusion. And I think you can run the gamut in between. And so monstrous work for me is to sort of think more positively than pejoratively about the work that many African American writers, laborers, people might do in the service of their own, what I later define as satisfaction, that exists outside of inclusiveness, citizenship, normative citizenship, heteronormativity, gender normativity, sexual normativity, all of those things.
And when you said work against the state, you don't mean work that is in opposition to the state, to the government, to authority, necessarily.
I don't mean that in total, that only that sort of work is monstrous. I think that work can be monstrous, right? But I'm saying any kind of labor that one does that does not conform to the normative modes of performance, of citizenship, that we historically kind of think of when we think of what it means to be an American, what it means to be a kind of good woman in the case of the work that I'm reading, right? What it means to be a woman, what it means to be a mother, what it means to be a wife, all of these categories of being, when one works against those normative modes, one is, in my argument, working monstrously, working against the state, working against all of the apparatuses in place that are supposed to kind of normalize us. And I think we might call it assimilation, right? The ways in which we are kind of encouraged to comport ourselves in a variety of venues in order to appear like we might be worthy of good of citizenship, of good treatment, of, let's even say, like a promotion at work, you know, all of the kind of big and small benefits that are promised to people who comport themselves in ways that align with American kind of nationalism.
And as you said, monstrous work can yield a kind of satisfaction. And your book title also includes the term radical satisfaction. What do you mean by that?
So radical satisfaction is kind of functioning in two ways. The first way, or one portion of the way, is to think about how Black women in the mid-century imagined a sense of completeness, of fullness, of, some might call it joy, outside of, again, this idea that one might feel completed by, in the case of desegregation, proximity to white people. So part of what I'm looking at in all of the chapters in the book is how African-American women writers imagined this satisfaction as possible with or without desegregation, or in particular, racial integration. Not because they did not believe in racial integration or that Black people were always and already equal to, you know, their white counterparts, or were always, you know, they did not believe that Black people were human. they always believed this. And so satisfaction becomes a way to register the ways in which these women imagined that sense of completeness that was rooted in self-regard, that was rooted in things like relationships with friends, relationships with children, brothers, sisters, family members, partners, that all of those things could produce. It's a kind of sociality, could produce satisfaction, and that the United States was offering kind of integration as one of the only models of Black satisfaction, that if we were to integrate, then we would be happy. And a number of the writers that I write about sort of think about this and come to a different conclusion. So that's one element of satisfaction. The radical has to do with another framework that's offered in the mid-century, communism. And because I'm looking in the 30s, 40s, 50s, so in the midst of, you know, post-World War II, in the midst of the Cold War, its beginning, right, there's this other movement, global movement, that many Black workers and many Black intellectuals are participatory in and or familiar with. The thing about Black women is, although they were politically savvy and politically aware, they weren't necessarily card-carrying communist. And even the ones that were, there are very few Black women, there are some, and I write about them, who are able to climb the infrastructure of the Communist Party in the USA. And so thinking about what if radicalism were a much wider, larger umbrella than kind of the radical left or this Communist Party in the USA, CPUSA. And so when I think about radicalism, one of the things that I want to do is make a space for Black women who would have been, and many of the writers that I write about are fellow travelers. Alice Childress, whom I write about, is probably most likely a communist. And so I'm thinking about the work that might not get one trailed by the FBI, but could be also considered radical because it is working against a kind of normative American model of inclusion. So it's a way to kind of register, again, monstrous work as radical work, even though it may not look like, you know, I'm a communist labor activist.
Another recurring concept in your book is ugliness. And this is the lens of ugliness, through which you read certain characters, certain protagonists in some of the books you take up by Black women writers. What do you mean by ugliness?
So again, I'm thinking of all the ways in which we can repurpose language, right? So there is a way, and a number of people have written on this idea of beauty, right? The beauty myth, the beauty benefit, so on and so forth. And Tressie Cottom was really useful for me in thinking about ugliness as a mode of, a useful mode of working through the world as a Black woman. Part of her thinking is that this idea of beauty is never about actually what you look like, but what she calls preferences that reproduce the existing social order. So if beauty is simply a reproduction of the normative, of the social order, then part of what ugliness does, the work of ugliness, is to resist that social order. And so if we're looking at the mid-century, the social order is segregation, right? The social order is white supremacy. The social order is sexism. So if you participate in beauty culture, you inherently are participating in reproducing that existing social order. But the other thing that Cottom says that I found really useful is that beauty is meant to exclude Blackness. And so I write about the ways in which, especially in the 70s, in the Black Power movement, that whole notion of Black is beautiful becomes a slogan meant to counter the exclusion of Blackness from beauty culture. And what I want to do, in particular in this chapter, where I look at the work of a writer like Ann Petrie, is really think about how she's using not beauty, but ugliness to counter the social order that's meant to exclude Black women, not just from beauty culture, but from any kinds of modes of upward mobility that they could imagine. In this particular novel, the mode that our protagonist, a character named Ludi Johnson, chooses, who is described over and over in the book as beautiful, as fairly proximate to the white women she works as a domestic at some point in the novel, the white women that she works for. So her beauty becomes, in that particular text, a real problem for her in a variety of ways. But there are a couple of ugly, quote unquote, characters who have very different outcomes, who achieve a certain level of freedom, a certain amount of autonomy that ultimately Ludi doesn't. So it's kind of tuning into that. Again, these ideas of normativity, of the social order, how do you resist it? And where might we look for that resistance in these literary texts?
Eve Dunbar is my guest. She is the Jean Webster Professor of English at Vassar College. We are talking about her new book, Monstrous Work and Radical Satisfaction, Black Women Writing Under Segregation. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And you're talking about one of the texts you analyze and examine in your book. This is Ann Petrie's 1946 novel, The Street, which, if you read Eve's book, you can be reminded perhaps that it's attracted a lot of attention in recent years. It was made a pick for the social media-based book club Now Read This. I guess this is the New York Times and PBS NewsHour. A reissued text came out with an introduction by a best-selling author, Tayari Jones. And let's talk, in more depth about the book. Ludie Johnson, the novel's protagonist, as you said, is perceived to be beautiful. Mrs. Hedges is one of the characters you identify as, well, first of all, she's not perceived as beautiful, and she provides what you call the counter experience of beauty within the novel. Talk more about Mrs. Hedges and what her ugliness or non-beauty consists of, and maybe even what Ludie Johnson thinks of her.
Sure. So in the novel, Mrs. Hedges becomes a foil, really, for Ludie. Ludie is not just beautiful, but she's this really ambitious single mother who wants a better life for herself and her son. And so she finds herself kind of apartment hunting in Harlem, and she comes upon this apartment building on 116th Street in Harlem, and a woman is looking out her window of the apartment building, and Ludie sees her, and she describes her as, quote, an enormous bulk of a woman, very black, with a rich and pleasant voice, but eyes that were still and malignant as the eyes of a snake. So Ludie sees her, and she sees someone who is, you know, at no point described as beautiful, is described as reptilian in the eyes, right? And very large and very black. So it's kind of going back to this idea, if beauty is a way to kind of conform or replicate social norms, then Mrs. Hedges stands in opposition to that replication of social norms, right? That beauty culture or an investment in beauty works to affirm. She is the thing that beauty excludes, right? This idea that beauty excludes blackness. So for Ludie to see her and remark on her very dark, very black skin is to signal to us that she's working on a different register. So that said, in addition, and I think more important than the fact that Mrs. Hedges is described as a big kind of woman at the window, we also come to know some other things about her in reading the novel. One, she's been disfigured. She's caught in an apartment fire, and she has to hurl herself through a basement window. But in the process, she's burned. And because she also exists in the same culture that every other person in the novel exists in, she also recognizes the importance of beauty. And now that she feels like it's totally no longer available to her, she concocts a different life for herself. And that life is actually as a madam. She runs an apartment, a brothel, out of her apartment in the building that Ludie, in the opening scene of the novel, is coming to kind of find an apartment in. And so there's a lot there at work with Mrs. Hedges, the disfigurement, but also the description of her size and her color, but more so the work that she's chosen. It is illegitimate work, right? It is work that goes against what is legal. And so Ludie has all sorts of feelings about it. And Ludie is deeply invested in this idea of an American dream. She finds herself modeling her life on Benjamin Franklin and this whole idea that she might, with hard work, become another Benjamin Franklin in this country. And so part of what we as readers have to do is to read, like, what is Petry saying about legitimate, viable work for a Black woman in this country? And what is the function then of the illegal or illegitimate work of someone like Mrs. Hedges? What does she illustrate?
Right. We could look down on Mrs. Hedges and her work. We could see her as doing something unacceptable and exploitative. And you certainly don't glamorize the work that Mrs. Hedges does. And yet you want to point to, and perhaps you want to correct me on this, certain positive aspects of what Mrs. Hedges is and what she does. And I think part of this relates to her setting, what she does within her apartment. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So her apartment is very important. It's one of the main floor apartments. Again, it looks out on the street. She spends a lot of time staring out the window, partially looking for potential Johns for the women who work in her brothel. But I also think about that apartment that she builds, and she comes to the work that she comes to. Prior to that, before the fire, she's doing domestic work. That was the sort of most available work for Black women in urban settings during the period. And so she comes and she's doing some of that. She's doing kind of picking up trash, stuff like that. She's got a lot of odd jobs to make ends meet. But the fire changes her and she gets this apartment. And one of the things that she does is she realizes she's going to need a little bit of help. And so she's kind of at the window and she sees a young girl. And she recognizes that this young girl is kind of unhappy. And they strike up a conversation. And what she also realizes, because she's friends with this, and this is probably one of the most difficult elements of her characterization, she's very close to a very powerful white man who makes most of his money in Harlem through sexual exploitation and through kind of nightlife, right? So he is a seedy fellow who makes money off of exploiting Black working people. And that in some ways is her best friend, if you will. So she's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. Again, she's participating and benefiting from sexual exploitation. And yet part of what Petry is very good at is making people complicated. So she builds in complexity to this exploitative relationship that Hedges has to the women who work in her brothel by giving us a first employee who is originally brought on to help her as she convalesces, and they realize that there's money to be made. And so she then kind of begins to work as a prostitute out of the apartment. And what Petry is able to do in that very complex relationship is to build in these little moments where you understand that there's something in excess of exploitation that's happening between the women in Hedges' apartment, right? So she describes the young women as oftentimes autonomously choosing this particular life because they see it, this underground economy, as a way for them to escape the exploitation of domestic labor, which is, again, legitimate, but one wonders if it's any less exploitative, and you can't keep your own hours, and you have no control over how the woman of the house that you're working in will treat you, if she'll pay you at the end of the day. There's all sorts of documentation that domestic workers were often not paid or paid less than they contracted in the morning to clean houses. So it's treated sort of like day labor. at some points. So these women are choosing this particular lifestyle because it provides them with a bit more autonomy, one, and perhaps not no less exploitation than they might have had they chosen legitimate work.
That's the voice of Eve Dunbar. She teaches English at Vassar College, the author of Black Regions of the Imagination, African-American Writers Between the Nation and the World, and co-editor of African-American Literature in Transition, 1930 to 1940. We are talking about her new book, Monstrous Work and Radical Satisfaction, Black Women Writing Under Segregation. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. And we are talking about The Street, a novel by Anne Petrie. Petrie is one of the four Black women writers that Eve focuses on in her book. The others are Dorothy West, Alice Childress, and Gwendolyn Brooks. So you conclude, in a sense, that Mrs. Hedges, this, quote, ugly woman doing, quote, ugly work, is a potential model for a form of liberation. I assume this has to do with the sort of community and mutual care that comes with the what you might call the radical satisfaction of the kind of work that she's doing.
Yes, I think so. And part of what I want to offer in turning an eye perhaps away from Ludi to a character like Hedges, who is not as central, of course, this is Ludi's story, but plays a relatively large role in this particular moment in Ludi's life, is that she's there obviously for a reason. Writers write characters for reasons. And to just sit with that reason and what it opens up was my own charge. And the conclusion that I came to was that when you look at some of the later work, Petrie takes on a couple of kind of historical figures, Harriet Tubman, and if you remember from your colonial education, the Salem witch trials, those all began with a Black and some argue indigenous woman, Tituba, who is brought to the colonies from Barbados. If we think about what these two women and these two young adult novels that Petrie would go on to write, historical kind of fiction, historical biography, kind of a mixed genre for young people. It's interesting for me to think about not Ludi, but Hedges as an early model for non-normativity. So to tell the story of Tubman is to tell the story of a fugitive from enslavement and somebody who is at every turn breaking the law. Right? She's breaking the law every time she shuttles an enslaved person out of slavery into the North. So again, to sort of tell the story of somebody who exists outside of legal frameworks, what is the law, and does important work historically, I think you have to think about how she begins to set that model up as early as The Street. If we look at someone like Hedges, not that Hedges and Tubman are equal. Again, I don't want to somehow glamorize the exploitation that is inherent in being a madam, but that she models something that I think Petrie takes up later.
So this book by Petrie, it's called Harriet Tubman, Conductor on the Underground Railroad, published in 1955. And you compare the book about Tubman, Petrie's book about Tubman, with the first biography of Tubman that came out by Sarah Bradford in 1869. The title of that book was Scenes in the Life of Harriet Tubman. How does Petrie's depiction of Tubman's heroism differ from Bradford's?
Bradford is writing from what appears to be a very generous and altruistic perspective or position. So she's writing on behalf of Tubman, who is in need of money, right? So she tells her readers that she's writing this book so that Tubman, Harriet Tubman, can purchase a home to bring her parents, who she's emancipated from their enslavement. And so it serves that purpose. And what Bradford understands is the hard sell of this biography is convincing these probably former abolitionists, because it's written, of course, after the end of enslavement. It's published in 1869. So slavery is no longer a part of the American landscape. But she also, it seems to me, understands that anti-blackness is part and parcel of the American landscape, and nobody's going to believe, or the hard sell again will be that her readers will understand Tubman as a hero. And so she kind of really deeply leans into this heroism and makes her this stupendous. And I think a lot of times this is how we're still taught Harriet Tubman, that she did all of these great things, which she did, which is to help enslaved people escape enslavement. And she describes her in these kind of superhuman ways. And I think what Petrie does is not to diminish the danger inherent in what Tubman participated in sort of ferrying enslaved people out of enslavement in Maryland, but also her work during the Civil War as a spy. Like, she's really gonna use all of that material, but she also does what Bradford doesn't, which is to invest the community out of which Tubman emerges, is born into and emerges, that plantation, that slave community, as always invested in their emancipation and their freedom. And so she spends a good bit of time describing the place and the people that Tubman grows up around and in. And so for me, that seems very important in telling a story that is dangerous ultimately to kind of mainstream understandings of enslavement and also resistance, right? So it's one thing to create a kind of superhuman Tubman who kind of imagines and carries out these clandestine Underground Railroad trips. It's a different thing altogether to imagine that she is taught by the people who she's enslaved with how to imagine a life of freedom, right? How to imagine emancipation. She understands herself as embedded in a network of Black people who can imagine and understand themselves as free. And she ultimately is able to harness that community and turn it into what we come to know as the Harriet Tubman story. And moreover, she tells the story of a community of Black people once Tubman reaches, you know, the free states, quote unquote, who it's not just white abolitionists who help Black people, but there's a Black community who are doing a lot of the work of ferrying people out of slavery. And so it becomes a much richer and a much more authentic story about Black liberation.
Yeah, very different from, and I'm just repeating what you said, very different from Sarah Bradford's a book which you write presents the story of a singular hero, a woman without community. Eve Dunbar is the Jean Webster Professor of English at Vassar College. We have a link to her new book, Monstrous Work and Radical Satisfaction, Black Women Writing Under Segregation, on our website, againstthegrain.org. The program is Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. As you mentioned, Anne Petrie also wrote a YA, a young adult, historical novel about Tituba, the enslaved woman who, after being brought to the Massachusetts colony, was accused of being a witch during the Salem witch trials of 1692-1693. Petrie's book is titled Tituba of Salem Village. It was published in 1964. Were you about to make a point about how Petrie depicts Tituba in that YA novel in light of how she portrays Mrs. Hedges in her novel, The Street?
I love this question, actually, because I think as soon as you asked it, the word that popped into my head in thinking about these two women is resilience. And I think, again, the description that Petrie makes of Hedges escaping the basement fire through the smallest hole you could imagine. And again, we know that she has a very large body, to free herself, to save herself, right? This idea, again, of self-reliance and resilience, I think is established very early there. And it's a different sort of resilience or self-reliance than Benjamin Franklin's, you know, up by the bootstraps that Ludi's interested in. So when we arrive in the 60s to her take on Tituba and the Salem witch trials, it's a little over a decade after Henry Miller's The Crucible kind of hits the scene. And she is interested in fleshing this character out. And part of what is really lovely to me about the book and her representation of Tituba is how super insightful she is about the nature of enslavement, right? Her status as enslaved person in the colonies, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And to sort of survey the community and see ultimately the rot of it. And the rot of it is the way in which it relies on the exploitation of enslaved people and indentured servants who have no rights, who are bound. They call them bound people. There's a moment when Tituba and her husband are talking and she's like, why won't you tell on this white woman? And he's like, because we're bound people and enslaved people have nobody to protect us, so we have to protect ourselves. And so this idea of resilience and the imagination as a mode of self-creation and also the way that Tituba is able to kind of, again, make herself whole or complete through imagining home, through understanding the situation that she's been placed in here in the colony, and to kind of really be able to read the white people around her and understand why witchcraft is so scary to them, but also never really allow their thinking about her to kind of shape who she imagines herself to be. Again, that resistance and that resilience is really profound to me.
Imagination as perhaps an avenue toward freedom. How do Tituba's thoughts about Barbados, which is where she comes from, and about the non-human world play into this imagination, perhaps shape the way she thinks beyond the current state of oppression and accusation in which she finds herself in?
Her capacity to remember, and the book uses the language of conjure, to conjure, right, which absolutely is bound to being, you know, when we say conjure, we think materializing the unreal, which is kind of what witches do, right? Her capacity to conjure a time and a place before her enslavement, not her enslavement because she was enslaved in Barbados, but there was a certain amount of freedom before she and her husband are taken to the colony. She imagines kind of escaping. She and her husband are used to pay a debt that her enslaver, her female enslaver, owes. So that's how she ends up in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. She looks up into the hills and thinks of the maroon colonies, right? So just out of her sight is this avenue of liberation. And she thinks about taking it, but ultimately she goes with her husband. But that idea that she is always able to conjure and to reimagine herself as potentially free is probably what's most dangerous about her. And this is the witchcraft of the Salem witch trials. And when she's conjuring, it's often in a water trough for the animals that she takes care of. And part of the reason why she's thought to be a witch in Petrie's story is because, unlike everybody else's animals, her animals don't get sick. And she can keep a really good house. And she says, you know, the problem with everybody else is that they don't do any work. And so they don't actually know how to care for. They can't do husbandry in the same fashion. And so she begins to see herself as bound in some ways to those domesticated animals. And rather than it simply being, you know, sad or unfortunate, it also becomes, again, the vessel through which she's able to conjure an imagination or an image of herself as liberated, as something more than what the Salem community is describing her as.
So, Eve, can you go to page 53, which is the end of the chapter we've been focusing on, and read, starting with From Sex Work to Self-Emancipation, and possibly elaborate on those sentences?
Sure. So I close the chapter with these thoughts. From sex work to self-emancipation to witchcraft, Petrie illustrates that what makes Black liberation so dangerous, ugly to the status quo of the nation, is its focus on collective action and the radical imagination. By refusing despair, rewriting history, emphasizing the power of storytelling, Petrie models for readers, young and adult, the importance of engaging the ugly work of Black liberation. So, part of, again, what I'm very much interested in the whole book and emerges in this first chapter is us thinking less pejoratively and more kind of in the realm of possibility of these things that are often described by the mainstream as negative, like being a criminal, being an enslaved person, being a witch, being a sex worker, all of these identities that exist outside of the law of the state. And thinking about how Petrie really digs into these kind of negative to the norm identities and experiences in order to model something that is much more liberatory. So she's offering us and me and readers of her work a way to find and imagine liberation in ways that don't require you to mold yourself into a mold that was never meant to contain you.
Eve Dunbar is her name. She teaches English at Vassar College. We're talking about her book, her new book, Monstrous Work and Radical Satisfaction, Black Women Writing Under Segregation. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you also address in this book texts written by Dorothy West, Alice Childress, and Gwendolyn Brooks. We don't have a lot of time, but could you maybe share some point that you're trying to make about these other writers in the other sections?
I would say the point that is carried throughout all of the chapters is that all of these women, West, Petrie, Brooks, Childress, are deeply invested in thinking about how Black women might, again, I think I phrased this earlier in the discussion, might find a sense of completeness or wholeness outside of the models being offered to them by the mainstream, by the state. And I think the thing that emerges across all of the chapters is my focus on characters who, or if not the character, moments that resist normativity, right? So in Dorothy West's work, it's going to look like an asexual Black woman who wants to put together an entire household filled with children and her sisters, which is kind of, to the deep anxiety of America, a matriarchal household, right? This would become really important for American representation of Black women. We get an idea of a welfare queen. And as early as the 40s, Dorothy West is going to say, well, what if that is somebody, not necessarily welfare queen, but what if one could find satisfaction and not be fearful of spaces that are run by Black women and aren't bound by heteronormativity and the traditional nuclear family? And I think each and every chapter is really interested in that idea. Like, what if we think differently about what looks to be something negative, or what would be considered negative or depicted in kind of mainstream American culture as a negative representation of Black people and Black women. I conclude with Gwendolyn Brooks's beautiful novella, Maud Martha. And part of what I'm interested in Maud Martha is, again, at this moment of desegregation, this period of American desegregation, rather than looking to the proximity one might have to white people, newfound proximity to white people, she says, what if it's actually animals that we should be thinking about more generatively? And it's very difficult because historically Black people have been animalized by the state, by enslavement, by white supremacy. And she's saying, what if we don't think so pejoratively about that? What can we learn from a proximity to animals that is actually more useful to us than a proximity to whiteness and white people? And so just those kind of inversions that they're all making become really productive for modeling, even now, how to resist a system that refuses to grant your humanity and treat you with equality.
Yeah, you said even now, and one can't help think about normative prevailing notions of race and gender and sexuality and all sorts of things that marginalize people, that when acted upon, dispossess people, harm people. So what can we learn from the writers you write about in your book and your arguments in this book about perhaps the outlook we might take to confront or to fortify us against what appears to many people as oppressive social and political norms?
Right after the election, one of the things that I thought was, this is the time for monstrous work, right? We've tried to conform and to play nice and to kind of follow the rules. And here we sit. Most people who can have children, bear children, you know, give birth, are subjected to a state that is trying to take away that bodily autonomy, has succeeded in a majority of American states. So we have to realign kind of our visions, to, in my mind, away from kind of the normative, the playing nice, playing by the rules of the people in power. Because when you play by the rules of the people in power, you're sort of set to kick the can and kick the can and kick the can. You're always going to be performing, and you're never going to get what you've been promised. And so I think for me, kind of at this moment, this idea of monstrous work resonates because it, you know, taking the stories, taking the lessons that those writers in the mid-century understood, in my mind, taking that idea that you can work towards your satisfaction, towards your liberation, towards your completeness, and you might actually be more successful than if you participate in the building up of the status quo, because the status quo will always prevail. And, you know, the problem with inclusion in the models that we've seen previous is that it's an opening of an umbrella without a complete reordering of the very nature, right? Maybe we don't need an umbrella and we don't all need to be included under the umbrella. We need, you know, to sit in the rain collectively and to reimagine the very nature of what it might mean to be dry together. And so, you know, to kind of extend that metaphor, just to really allow ourselves to think outside of the status quo, I think is the biggest lesson that I'm kind of internalizing right now from writing this book and reading the writers that I've read.
Eve Dunbar, professor of English at Vassar College, the author of Black Regions of the Imagination, co-editor of African American Literature in Transition. We've been talking about her new book, Monstrous Work and Radical Satisfaction, Black Women Writing Under Segregation, published by the University of Minnesota Press. Eve, thanks very much for writing this book and for joining me today.
Thank you so much, CS, for having me. I enjoyed talking with you.
And that interview was recorded on November 12th, 2024. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more.